radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Cyberspace is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. Then you enter an entirely new place. Once you get on the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here from the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Rainbow Soul channel of the Blake Radio Network. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We started off the program with a message in the music from Sounds of Blackness, African Medley. And that sets the stage for our guest, familiar voice and personage here on Rainbow Soul, Professor Manu Ampem. He's a scholar, researcher, author, archaeologist, and an activist. And his latest venture is the Save Nubia Project. And we'll speak with him following these messages, which will include a PSA on the Save Nubia Project. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. We'd like to welcome everybody checking in from Real Media Player, from Windows Media Player, from iTunes. We want to encourage everyone to log into our website, which is blakeradio.com, and become familiar with how you can access our broadcast directly from our website. And vice versa, those of you who check in directly from the Blake Radio Network, become familiar with how you can also access us through Real Media Player, through Windows Media Player, and iTunes by logging into their radio tuner guides and doing a search for us in the talk radio genre. You're listening to Rainbow Soul, talk radio at its best.
Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com. Or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address, and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support.
I am Professor Manu Ampem. Our Save Nubia campaign is focused on preserving the ancient African civilizations of Kush and Nubia, which must be considered World Heritage Sites under threat. These great civilizations along the Nile in Northeast Africa are in jeopardy of having their central areas permanently flooded. Currently, the Sudanese government is in the process of building four new dams in northern and central Sudan to create hydroelectricity. However, local Sudanese groups in these regions oppose these dam projects because they will destroy their homelands and way of life along the Nile. The Nubians, the Manasseh, and the Amri are among the groups that oppose these projects. In fact, the World Commission on Dams examined over 1,000 of the 45,000 large dams around the world. And in its report, the commission made it clear that no dam should be built unless the local affected communities agree to the project and are consulted at each stage of the construction process. And of course, none of this has taken place in the Sudan. For example, the people were not even consulted about the recently completed Marowei Dam at the Fourth Cataract, which was completed in 2008 and created a 108-mile-long reservoir, which displaced about 70,000 people and flooded a minimum of 2,500 unexcavated ancient Kushite archaeological sites. The Manasir and other displaced groups still have not been compensated for the flooding of their homeland. Let's be clear that electricity is an uncontested factor for a country to develop, but the means to acquire this electricity is often contested and controversial. There are other viable forms of energy available in the Sudan, such as solar panels and wind turbines. But these alternate sources of energy have not been considered because they are not as financially lucrative for those involved. The Save Nubia campaign is in support of the local people in their efforts to save their homeland. The four proposed dams in the Sudan will each have a devastating impact on this archaeological region. The second through the fifth cataracts represent a central corridor of the ancient Kush and Nubia regions. Despite Sudanese sites of El Kuru, Nuri, Jebel Barkel, Dongola, Bagrawiya, and Merol, which yield 223 pyramids in Sudan, there is still much more in this vast archaeological region that is not known because of the lack of excavation work and field research. For example, during the construction of the Marowei Dam, there was a shocking discovery of 700 brand-new, previously unknown archaeological sites that were found in just 1 year, which all are now flooded. Our Save Nubia campaign has several goals. One, to raise funds to conduct ongoing field research to thoroughly document the historical significance of this region. Two, press forward with our campaign until this rich archaeological region is considered by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site under threat. Three, assist the local Sudanese people in the second and third cataract areas to build 2 to 3 museums to help highlight and preserve their heritage and historical contributions to the world. Join our campaign. Assist us in making a difference in preserving ancient African history and culture. Our voice is the call of the local Sudanese people who have asked that we help to amplify the volume of their struggle for cultural survival. The Nubians say that they have seen the negative impact of the Aswan High Dam in southern Egypt and the Marowei Dam in northern Sudan, and they don't trust the current dam construction collaboration between the Sudanese government on the one hand and the Chinese construction companies on the other. The 2007 Kashbar Dam massacre is an example of this grassroots effort of cultural resistance to the dams. We cannot allow the historical evidence of African greatness to be destroyed on our watch. I trust that you will use your time, your talent, and your resources to contribute to our campaign to save the ancient African civilizations of Kush and Nubia. Join our cause.
Peace, Professor Griff. You're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griff from Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
Our guest is Professor Mainu Ampim. Many of you are familiar with him because he has a program here on Rainbow Soul, has been a major contributor to the Blake Radio Network over the years. You've seen his work. You've read his books. He's an author. He's a world traveler. He's a scholar. He has taken on the mission of telling the truth, righting the wrongs, debunking the lies put forth by the white supremacists. And now he's taken on a huge challenge to prevent the flooding of several areas in Sudan because the Sudanese government, in cooperation with their Chinese partners, are designing and preparing to implement several dams that will displace hundreds of thousands of people and quite possibly destroy thousands of years of artifacts and African history. And we'll let him tell us more about that during the course of the program. Welcome, brother. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Brother Junius. All is well.
Well, that's good. That's good. Last time we talked to you, you were getting ready to take a tour to Africa. And the next thing I hear from you, I receive that I saw your videos up on YouTube, and we'll talk about that. But this project in Sudan, in Nubia, how did that come about?
Well, last summer, brother, I went to I took a group to Ethiopia, but after they left, I went and did and continued field research in Sudan because what I was concerned about is there are four projected dams that the Sudanese government are going to build, and these dams are in central and northern Sudan, and they will be created to, in theory, create hydroelectricity, and people assume that is to make the lives of the local people in those areas better, but we learned before that that's not the case. With the Merowe Dam that was completed in 2008 in Sudan, when that was finished, that dam not only dislocated about 70,000 people, but it flooded 2,500 ancient Kushite archaeological sites. But the more dastardly part of it is that the local people, the Manasir, the Amri, and the Nubians, were not only were they not consulted about the Merowe Dam and told about it, but they were not even compensated after the dam was built. And even more sinister is then we find out that the Merowe Dam, which was a $1.7 billion project, really was not about creating electricity for the local people, because much of that electricity is being exported to neighboring countries. So it had nothing to do with helping the local people. So knowing what happened with the Merowe Dam, and I was there to document the archaeological areas before that dam was finished. So I went last summer to see about these projected dams along the Nile, and it's shocking what is about to take place if we don't raise our voice, because what is going to happen unless we intercede is that the living entity, the Nile River, would be turned into a series of isolated lakes, because any time a dam is built, the water backs up and creates a large lake or reservoir, so everything in its place is flooded. Artifacts, homes, you name it, everything is destroyed. And so the World Commission on Dams made it very clear that no dam in the world should be built unless the local people agree and are part of this process of being consulted along the way, and this is not taking place in a Sudan, and there's no projection of this taking place, and that's why the local people themselves have rose up and continue to rise up against the dams in Sudan. And my visit was to do reconnaissance work, to find investigation, to find out exactly what was happening, and is what I suspected, that the people need international help to amplify their voice so that this does not take place, meaning that they are not dislocated from their homeland, and that their historical homelands are not flooded so that the world is unaware of the great African contributions from the areas of ancient Kush and Nubia, which the heartland was in current-day Sudan.
Now, you mentioned the Merowe Dam, which was constructed in 2008. That was a replica of what happened with the Great High Dam in Aswan also. And
exactly.
There are still ill feelings with many of the Nubians because of what happened and how they. I had an opportunity to go on several tours to Egypt, and we had a Nubian guide, and he was adamant about how, even though he was a young man, how his family was immediately impacted by that dam, and what happened. So now you're saying this Meroe Dam in 2008, and now you're seeing a replication of that with these other dams. And I want to ask you, I did a show on the land grabs in Eastern Africa, as well as the water situation with the other countries that contribute to the Nile. Is this part of that also? Because I think all of this is interconnected, in your view.
Yeah, I think it is, because there are always the potential for water wars along the Nile, because the Nile River is the longest river in the world, more than 4,100 miles long, and there's 9 countries that benefit from the Nile. So, you know, when dams are being built, it not only alters and damages the ecosystem and how people use the water. You know, the Nubians and others said, we don't want this to take place. This is our life. This is where we eat. We eat fish. We travel on this in the water. This is our, you know, this is our great relative, is what they say. And so what's happening now is the Nubians in Sudan have seen the effect, the negative effects of the Aswan High Dam and the Meroe Dam, and this is why they and others are challenging the dams that are projected to be built at the second cataract, which is the Dal Dam, and then there's the Kashbar Dam at the third cataract, and these two new dams are in Nubian regions, and anybody can actually go online, Brother Junius, to they can go to YouTube and look at the Kashbar massacre that took place in 2007, when the local people in that area of northern Sudan saw equipment coming in and foreign workers from China and all of these people coming into their lands. They rose up because they were not notified, and they had peaceful protests, and the government shot down, literally killed 4 people because they were peacefully protesting. And so they, you can see the fire, the smoke bombs that were dropped, and then all of a sudden you have live ammunition with people who were unarmed, simply demonstrating for their rights. So this is taking place, and just last Monday, June 25th, there's a very interesting article that we posted on our website, SaveNubia.org, and it's about the indigenous Nubians in Egypt who are still battling for not only compensation that they never received, but also they are taking lands since the Arab Spring last year. When that happened, now the Nubians have used that as a springboard to be able to take some of the land in the southern part of Egypt that they were dislocated from, and because the government has never given them any kind of money, any kind of respect or anything, but they are taking land now and buying land so that they can invite Nubians to return back to the southern area where they previously were, so that they can attempt to pull together, piece together, and rebuild their culture. But yes, there are many people who are now shifting. And one other thing about the Sudan that's very interesting, many people have said when I visited the Sudan that a lot of what is happening, or what was happening even more prominently in western Sudan, in Darfur.
Right,
people know
right,
about
right.
Darfur. But a lot of that had to do with
oil.
Yeah, about the local people being displaced,
mm-hmm.
and then Arabs, literally Arabs coming in from Egypt and other places to take the land that the Africans were being dislocated from. So there is a lot of movement that is taking place as people are looking to stake their claim in these lands. And so Nubians and other groups are right in the middle of this effort to secure their homeland.
Now, you mentioned Darfur and the Arabs coming in. One of the questions I was going to ask you, how does this reflect on what has happened in the last couple of years with the bifurcation of Sudan? Now you have northern Sudan, and then now you have South Sudan, and the Arab African split and animus that has existed for a while because the Nubians have resisted. They refused to learn and speak Arabic, at least the ones I met up in Aswan, where they a lot of them have accepted Islam, but they have their own language and they refuse to kowtow to the Arabs. Is this part and parcel of that ongoing thing with Darfur? And I maintain they've been being used by the Western powers because there's oil in that region, and also there's oil in southern Sudan now. So elaborate on these resource wars, not just the water with the surrounding countries, but the internal politics in Sudan that resulted in the bifurcation of the country, and how will that impact what you're doing? I mean, it's like a threefold question.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, you know, as the listeners will know, that last summer, South Sudan voted in a referendum to break away from Sudan and become an independent country. So it's the newest country in the world. So now you have two Sudans. And the reason for that is that the war in Darfur was going on, where you have the Darfurians fighting against agents of the government based in Khartoum. So that war was happening in the west, Darfur. But in the south, there's been an ongoing war because of the fact that the Bashir government has been attempting to impose Sharia or Islamic law on the southerners. And the southerners, they practice traditional African religions, and then there are many also that are Christians, but they're not Muslims. And so they don't embrace Islam. They don't embrace those things related to Islam and the language of Arabic. And so they didn't want any law, Sharia law, imposed on them. So they have resisted that. And so really, what has happened now? You have a split between the north and the south, and so this is a growing conflict. I mean, it wasn't. So Bashir said, no problem, you can split. But there are ongoing battles all the time. If somebody really looked at the news there, they can see that there's a lot of fighting that takes place. When we're doing field work, for example, when I'm there, it's really in Sudan proper. So it's in the north. So that conflict between the government and South Sudan really does not impact what I do directly. Indirectly, yes, because as we travel around the country, there are security checkpoints. And, you know, of course, they assume that you might be from the south or the west causing problems, because I pass, when it's convenient for me, as Sudanese. I have to do that because when I'm in Egypt, you know, many of these people who see that I'm African, they think that I'm from the U.S. or some place where I have a ton of money, so mm-hmm. they can exploit mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
So when I say, no, I'm Sudanese, okay, so that they back away because they know that I know, and so I'm not to be dealt with. But in Sudan, they figure that I'm from one of the other regions, but when I have to give my ID and show my U.S. passport, usually the problems subside at that point. But basically, people are on high alert at the checkpoints. But it's interesting, too, Brother Junius, because if you go to Khartoum, let me not say that. I was going to say if you go to Khartoum, the capital, you really wouldn't know that all of these things are taking place. But that's beginning to change now. Just as of, you know, maybe the last 3 to 6 months, things are beginning to change whereby even in the larger cities, you have people who are activists who are going to make their point in Khartoum, where the Bashir government is situated. But before then, interestingly, the average person in those areas did not know about these conflicts, literally. And if they did, they didn't care whatsoever. But our work, and my work as a historian, is really to go in and to deal with the fate of the artifacts and the monuments. So for the most part, it's always important to be aware of all these political situations, but we don't get caught up in that because, you know, these things will go on forever, or at least for quite some time. My specific task is to help preserve the historical knowledge. And by the way, if this was associated, if these dams were associated in any way with ancient Greece or Rome, there would be international outcry. As a matter of fact, if anybody had even projected building a dam that could even possibly damage or flood ancient European artifacts, that the person who came up with the idea would probably be assassinated on site. But here, people don't even bother with it, brother, because it's not on CNN, BBC, and so they hear your program, and you do an excellent job, but some people are looking for your work mysteriously to be validated by mainstream media. And then, I'm not talking about just the average person. I'm really referring to those people who say that they know, who say that they see, and yet if they don't hear it on these major news outlets, for some reason, they don't think that it's as serious as we make it.
Well, I was going to ask you, it's almost like you're anticipating my questions. I was going to ask you, because of a resurgence in interest in Nubia, Sudan, Kush, those regions, do you think that the push to have these dams, which will basically inundate those regions and submerge them forever and not allow the grandeur of those civilizations to be known, is that part of some grand conspiracy theory? Or, I mean, because I tend to think that way, and particularly after you said that the hydroelectricity is not benefiting the immediate residents of the area. They're siphoning and selling it off to other regions. And I know for a fact that there are other countries that want the water. They want to get a toehold on the resources in all of the Horn of Africa also. And so if they can kill three birds with one stone, meaning that they can undermine African awareness of the greatness of Nubia and how, in fact, Nubia influenced the northern region of Kemet, they really hit the jackpot, hit the trifecta.
Yeah, it's no doubt there. You know, it's no doubt. So it's really about, it's a couple of things. One is the Nubians. The people who live there, they say that it's clear that these dam projects, and there's more than one way to spell dam projects, by the way, these dam projects are clear evidence that it's an attempt to destroy their heritage and homeland. So they're clear about it. And it's important for the listeners to know, because I know that there's somebody who's thinking, oh, well, you know, here we go again. There's some outsiders who are trying to tell the local people what's best for them, and we should be concerned about our situation here and not dictate to the people. Well, first of all, that has nothing to do with facts. The local people themselves disagree with all this. And so I mentioned the Kashbar Dam Massacre. Anybody can see that. It's public. It's a horrendous act against innocent people. Not only that, but here in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., and New York, the Nubians have demonstrated in our cities about what's going on. So nobody can misinterpret our efforts and say that we're trying to impose on somebody else our ideas. And then also important here is that there are other sources of energy besides building dams and destroying the whole ecosystem and destroying the archaeological artifacts in the area and displacing people. There are solar panels that could be used, solar energy, and also wind turbine. Look, the fact is that the heartland of ancient Kush in Nubia, the actual heartland was in current-day Sudan, but it extended in the whole region. It extended into current-day Egypt and Djibouti, Eritrea, Somalia, even across the Red Sea into Yemen and Saudi Arabia. But the heartland, the political government, and the religious capital were in Sudan. And but anyway, that area is part of the Sahara. This is a vast desert. So obviously, with a vast desert, there is sun most of the day. So you have solar energy that's available, and probably interesting for most people, but it is cold at night in the desert. It is cold. It is windy. So it is easy to put in establish wind turbines as well to create energy that are more eco-friendly and more effective. But that's not being considered, those two alternative sources of energy, because they're not as lucrative for others. So that's important for people to know those things before they have a false view that somebody wants to stop these people from having a better lifestyle. That's not the case at all. We know that energy is important for so-called modern development, but the way in which the energy is created, that's what's controversial, and it is certainly controversial to the Nubians. So to me, if somebody wants to use the word conspiracy, they can if they want. But the fact is, the Nubians are clear about the evidence that clearly establishes that there's a consistent plot. And it seems to me that the evidence speaks for itself. Documentation beats conversation. If someone says that's not the case, then they will have to explain, well, why is this taking place in the middle of the heartland of one of the greatest civilization complexes in the history of the world? It's right in the middle of it. And why the rush? And why the violation of the indigenous people's rights? They have never had a say-so. And Brother Junius, when I went to Sudan last summer, I go to the Cash Bar Dam area, and the people took me to the areas where the people from the villages of Sabo and Jeti, that they rose up and challenged the government in their demonstrations, and how they ran the Chinese workers out because they were digging up human remains. That they had dug up a bunch of human remains until the local people made them stop, and they kicked them out. So now if you go to the area, you see the fence that they built around the Chinese construction companies. You see the fence that they built around their buildings, and they have a large tower there. But that's where they were running their operations until the people ran them out, because they know. And so now, who knows? Because the Sudanese government has not made it public, and they're not going to make it public when they plan to go back into the area. So it's kind of a cat-and-mouse game, because they want to catch the local people off guard so they can come in with their workers, with their equipment, with their security and military to keep the people at bay. But the people are ready for this. They're ready. So who knows where the government's going to strike. They may start to try to go to another area first. Maybe they go to the Dal Dam area. Maybe they go to the Shariq Dam area first. Or maybe they try to go back to the hotbed, which is the Kashbar area. We don't know. So my work, though, as a historian, is to record and document what we can to make sure that we can preserve as much as possible, and then make a case to the United Nations that this region should be and must be considered. It must be designated as a World Heritage Site under threat. That's my goal, and that's my role as a historian. So that's what our work is for the upcoming season, is to do field research so we can produce a high-quality professional DVD documentary to thoroughly document that this region, northern and central Sudan, has to be considered one of the great World Heritage Sites, so it should be preserved. So find another source or sources of energy, and not the one that has caused so much destruction around the world, these large dams, that is.
We're speaking with Professor Mainu Ampem, who's a college instructor. He's a historian. He's an author. He has had media experience on the Blake Radio Network. He has initiated the Save Nubia Project. You can see it. Go up to YouTube. You can see his initial film on what's going on. You have a website, and you're also attempting to raise consciousness and money to do what you just said, which is have a full-fledged documentary on it, as well as to garner support for your efforts to go to the United Nations, as well as to continue your work, your field research work. So give us the URL for your website and tell us how folks can be of assistance in what you're doing.
Okay, I appreciate that. So folks can go directly to our website, which is savenubia.org. That's the official website, and all of our details are there. And also, our campaign is to raise $50,000 so that we can do the work, because it's difficult, really, for me to go out by myself, as I have, along with my Sudanese colleague, to go out in the field. So this is really to put together a team, a professional technical team, and we also need a couple other specialists. So this would allow us to work in the field for several weeks and produce the work. So our campaign, people can see that at SaveNubia.org. And the ways people can contribute, we have different products like Save Nubia T-shirts, DVDs. We have a pocket calendar for 2012. The 2013 will be out soon. Save Nubia writing pens, Save Nubia caps. So there's useful apparel that people can purchase, which would help. There's DVDs, educational material, and then also just donations. So we've had people, since our website was launched last weekend, we now have people who have made donations to help the cause. And then also people can, as you say, follow us on Facebook. Just go to Save Nubia Project, or Twitter, Save Nubia, YouTube, Save Nubia Project. So we're there, and also Vimeo. And then the key, too, is for people to look at our five-minute promotional video. The five-minute promo gives an overview of the project, what's at stake, and how people can assist, and then share this with their network. So we need people to contribute financially, but also to spread the word as well, and make sure people are aware of what's happening. And this is a real issue, and we don't want anybody to underestimate what will happen if people don't act. So all of this talk about, oh, my Nubian brother or my Nubian sister, that sounds good, but what are people going to do to help save Nubia now that the time has come? So that's what we need, and our SaveNubia.org website does a pretty decent job of presenting our case.
Now, you have a mailing address in addition to the website that people could send their donations?
Yes. We do, because I know everybody's not online. In fact, there's a group here that one of the ladies, she's not going to do online donations, so she gives her money. But the our mailing address is P.O. Box 18623. That's P.O. Box 18623, Oakland, California, 94619. That's 18623, P.O. Box, Oakland, 94619, and that's our mailing address. And then also the phone number is 510-273-2456. That's 510-273-2456. So those are the ways we can be reached. Also email, which is info@savenubia.org. And I'm the coordinator for the project, but we're fortunate enough, Brother Junius, to have people that are stepping up and assisting the work that I've been doing for years, because they understand, they truly understand what's at stake.
Well, more and more of our people are coming on board and coming online. They understand the value of Nubia. I saw several years ago Tony Browder started and digging at a site. You've been doing field research for years. And so would part of your strategy be to encourage more excavation, more research, so that you buttress your case that, in fact, the area is awash with historical evidence, historical significance, so that people will be reticent to flood it? Now, a lot of folks don't know that when you go up to Aswan and you see Abu Simbel, that there was a major project to save that, because if it hadn't been done, that would have been inundated in the lake. But they took those temples piece by piece and reassembled them at their present site, but they were actually in the path to be a swamp by the dam. So would you say that even more exploration and more attention on the historical significance of that region would buttress your case?
It would. Yes, it would. And that's part of the effort of the documentary that we're going to produce, is to really present that case, that the oldest of these classical African civilizations is Kush, and then Nubia, and then Kemet. And so the further we go back, we see Kush, and very little is known about it. I mean, you even have people who do archaeological work in the area of Northeast Africa along the Nile that are thoroughly confused. I mean, they'll take an image, a drawing or something like that, or even a statue, and say, oh, this is a Nubian statue. Excuse me, it's not a Nubian statue. The text clearly says this is from Kush, but they mix and mingle because they don't know. So there's much more to be known, but we've had historians who've talked about the significance of Kush. And then, you know, when the Greeks came along so many years later, they, for their own reasons, they changed the name from Kush to Ethiopia. But they were referring to ancient Kush. And but we've had historians that have written about the significance of Kush, even though they may have called it Ethiopia, like the great John Jackson in his pamphlet on Ethiopia and the Origin of Civilization. He's referring to Kush, or Drusilla Dunder Houston. Mm-hmm. Back in 1926, she wrote the wonderful Ethiopia of the ancient Kushite Empire. So we've had people writing about this for quite some time, but the more that's known about the significance of Kush in Nubia, then the better it is. And interestingly enough, mainstream Egyptologists have also initiated their own campaign. They have their own petition campaign to help save the region. So they're aware too. And even though, you know, a lot of them are focused on Egypt, some are dealing with Nubia, but very few are dealing further south with Kush. And this is important. And also, you know, in terms of our strategy, Brother Junius, we call it the Save Nubia Project because the name Nubia is more well known. Because when, like you mentioned, you've gone to Kemet a few times. Well, when I take groups to Egypt or to Kemet, and when we go through the itinerary, people are really surprised and excited to know that we're actually going to go and spend time with real-life Nubians and go to a real Nubian village and meet with children, Nubian elders. They're excited by that because they've heard about Nubia, but they just think it's legend and myth. But so it's more well-known than Kush. So we call it the Save Nubia Project because people can more relate to that, but we explain that Kush came first, and the Kushite artifacts and the Kushite influence is absolutely seminal to the area. And that's why the construction of the Meroway Dam in 2008, right at the Fourth Cataract area, when that flooded that 108-mile area, all of those artifacts that are under that lake now, 2,500 brand-new, previously unknown, unexcavated archaeological sites, not artifacts, but whole sites, 2,500 from Kushite, including an ancient pyramid site at Tarif, including the gold production area of Hush El Guruf. This area is gone. So it's not only that the gold was found at Hush El Guruf, but this was a gold distribution center. And we know that gold is plentiful in the area. And even the word Nubia comes from the root nub or nub, which means gold. So it was really the land of gold. And since I've gone there, since last summer when I was there, you go out to these desert environments to go to the sites to see what will be flooded, to go to the villages and find out what the people are thinking and saying about this and what are they doing. And it's interesting, the only thing you see out there, if anything, you'll see some people out, you see these white tents in the middle of the desert, middle of the day, super hot, but they're there because they're prospecting for gold. And since I've left, the gold rush in northern Sudan has increased. Now you got people contacting friends and relatives in numerous Western countries, the U.S. and throughout Europe, looking for anybody that could could muster up the money and send them gold prospecting equipment. And because people want, because they hear stories about so many people striking it rich, they're finding gold out in the desert areas of Sudan. So we know that whole region was rich with gold, but some of that flooded, and more flooding would take place. I told my colleague, I said, look, I'm from California. We had a gold rush here.
Yeah.
I'm a historian in California, and I teach California history. And I said, let me tell you something, that there was a gold rush here, and all, most of those people that tried to come and relocate to Northern California, strike it rich, and then go home with a ton of money, that did not take place for the vast majority of people. They came here. They didn't make any money. They didn't really find gold, and they stayed here for the rest of their life. And some of the people here are descendants of these folks because they never made it back. So for every story you hear of somebody finding gold, there's 10 that didn't find anything, but now there's a mad rush. It literally is a rush, and this influence of gold prospecting is increasing at an alarming rate. So we don't even know really at how widely this would have been during the ancient Kushite period. All we know is that some of the sites are flooded forever. And what made Kush and Nubia so powerful? Gold. That's one of the commodities, gold and ivory. They traded in leopard skins and incense such as frankincense and myrrh. Those are the items that allowed them to have so many trading items that they became very powerful civilizations. And that that gave them the kind of economic or commercial influence that allowed them to really emerge. And so there's much more to be known. But I can tell anybody, if they look at Kushite drawings and images, they can see trade taking place. You can see all of these different items. So we have no idea what will be lost. And not only that, but if the Et-Tarif pyramid, when that was found, right before the Meroe Dam was found, what's interesting to me is that there's no such thing as a pyramid in isolation. Every pyramid
a whole complex in itself, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So there's connected buildings. Of course, those weren't found because there wasn't enough time. You don't go in a few months or even a couple of years and excavate a site. This takes decades, but that will never be done now because, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, this is the permanent destruction of these archaeological sites, and we cannot allow that on our watch.
Now, have you found any instance, because I saw some things, and then when you go to Aswan and you see the unfinished obelisk, it seems that many of the stones were from the interior. So is any indication, have you found any indications of quarries where the people of Kemet got the stones for the pyramids and the capstones for the various pyramids that they constructed?
Well, pretty much as you mentioned, the furthest quarry would be the Aswan quarry for the people of Kemet. So they went as far south as Aswan to build. They would get the granite. They got the pink granite. People call it red, but it's clearly pink granite from the area. And the pink granite was usually, that's what they would use to construct temples because of the hard nature of the granite. But if we then go further south, actually there's twice as many pyramids in Sudan as there is in Kemet. So there's 223 pyramids in Sudan. So there are different quarries there. And also there are massive tekken or obelisk structures in Ethiopia, which, again, the Greeks changed the name to Kush, but there is near Aksum, right there at Aksum, you have a granite quarry there. So you had people in the region using stone that would be local to them, or they may travel, but they would travel to the nearest quarry. So the people in Kemet satisfied their needs by going to Aswan in the south, and then they would go to other quarries if they needed limestone or guayrac or basalt. So some of these quarries have been found, but in Sudan, there's much more to be known. We don't know, and by the way, brother, to show you how much of a challenge it is to teach, to expand people's understanding is that we hear often about this group of people called Egyptologists, people who study, professional people who study Egypt. We call ourselves Kemetologists because this is dealing with old Kemet before the invasion of foreigners.
Right, right.
Those who are dealing with Egyptology, they want to start from the foreign period, the Greeks, and then change all the names to Greek names. For what? There's no reason to do that. So you got the term Egyptologist, but we don't hear the term Nubiologist very often, and we never hear the term, never hear Kushologist. The reason why we don't hear Kushologist is because people are not specialists. They don't know. Why haven't we heard that as often as Egyptologists? Because there's very few people who focused on it. So that means that we have a possibility of the flooding and destruction of the area, and we're not even knowledgeable about what's really there. Even though, yes, there's monuments, and I was telling some folks recently that, look, you can go to some of the great pyramid sites in Sudan, not some, but just about every single one, with rare exception, and there's nobody there. There's no guards. There's
right,
no protection
right,
of the
right,
monument.
Right,
it's just
right.
off the side of the road. You can stop at the Gebel Barkel pyramids and go and do what you want, when you want, the way you want to do it, and nobody will ever see you. You can go to El Kul. There's nobody there, literally nobody there. You can do what you want. And the great capital city of Meroe, not Meroe, where the dam was built, but Meroe. This is a little further south, M-E-R-O-E. But Meroe, the great capital city, there is nothing indicating that there was anything there, really. Not any, you wouldn't know it other than an old, tattered, beat-up sign. And then you would have to walk past the sign and use honing skills, because when I first went with my colleague, he said, oh, brother, there's nothing here. I said, no, brother, no, it's a lot here. So I said, look, here's the telltale sign that there is things here. I said, look, you see the ground here? He said, yeah, yeah. I said, okay, take a look at these pot shards, the pot fragments. He says, look at all the, I'll say, the fact that these are ancient pots, and I'm showing him how to identify that these are not modern pottery. These are fragments of ancient pots. So you follow that. So see these marks here? This is old. This is ancient. This is the black top pottery, the burnt pottery. We found that. And we use that to find the central axis of the temple. And then we start to see some of the remains of the structures, the avenue leading to the Holy of Holies and other places, the old columns, the line of sphinxes and other things, other structures that are there. But you would never really, I mean, you know, the average person or even above average person wouldn't really find it because how would you know? In fact, even that old, tattered, beat-up sign, it says, like it's an archaeological area, but it doesn't even mention the name Meroe. So that's what we're up against here, and you got people that go about their daily lives in Sudan who don't care about these sites. And the reason why is because the Sudan is not a tourist country.
Right,
the British,
right.
The British really destroyed the country when they were there. So it's not a tourist country. So in other words, what that means is that if there's no industry, so no one would get paid for being a security guard or a guide because it's not like Egypt. So it's like it doesn't mean anything to people because it doesn't translate on a practical level, which I understand. But really, we hope to change this. We hope to change this with the Save Nubia Project.
Well, one of the things that I believe is that because it's so old and because of the desertification, a lot of the antiquities are covered by the sand. So this, what you're doing is just barely the tip of the iceberg. You have to save the whole region because I believe there's much, much more buried further out from, say, the Nile itself. Even though the Nile was a lifeblood, there's indication that it was not always desert, say 5,000 years ago. So I believe that as long as it's preserved, you'll find evidence of a great civilization. May not necessarily be urban centers, may not be necessarily be temples, but you'll find maybe some of the smelting of the iron that was prevalent in the region, and maybe some of the gold, as well as, you know, villages that will give you some insight in how our ancestors lived.
Yeah, no, you're right. And you know, adding to that is, you know, because someone asked the other day about, they asked if the pyramids in Sudan, if they're older than the pyramids in Giza. Well, they said the pyramids in Egypt, but I know they meant the pyramids in Giza. So, no, actually the pyramids in Giza in Egypt are actually older, because in Sudan what we're looking at is the top level. We're looking at the more recent level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So to the further we dig down, we'll get to the more older, more ancient levels. So we're looking at, just as you say, it's the tip. And this, and you know, like my students, every semester I teach a U.S. history course at the college, and when I'm explaining this to them, I say, okay, so I explain all of the details of how this works, how sites are dated, and then I show them an image. It's okay, take a look at this. And I show them a modern picture of Mexico City. And archaeologists, just in the last couple of years, underneath the current streets, you see these large buildings in Mexico City, major street, cars, and then underneath, maybe about 15 feet below ground level, the archaeologists there found remains of the Temple Mayor, the great Aztec temple. So that would take, take just going down about 15 feet, 12 to 15 feet, that's 500 to 700 years, just that.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
What's beneath the Aztec level? Then you have to look at the Toltec and the Mayan, and then below that would be the Olmec level, the further you go down. And so you got these different layers. So what we're looking at in Sudan is just the top level, and that's it. And as I said before, very few people have specialized in the area, and very few people have used or even heard of a term Kushologist, because we don't have people specializing in it. So, yes, there's no doubt that what I'm doing is helping to preserve what we have. That's why we say in our Save Nubia campaign that 5,000 years of African history will be lost. We're just talking about what's seen now, what's visible
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, and because one of my colleagues, oh, brother, why you say 5,000? I said, brother, I know. So we needed a number that people could relate to. But I said I'm perfectly clear that there are other levels beneath the current level. And that's also, I love showing that because it's as visual as it gets. So there's two places in Kemet when I take groups that I show the same thing, where you can, it's a shocking, somebody walking around on the pavement, and then you take out a large piece of the walkway, and you see a temple underneath where people are walking and standing. It's totally shocking. That is something that is there in Sudan. We just have to expose these earlier levels to really give people a glimpse of what really is going to be lost, even beyond the current
right,
layer
right,
and stuff. And you
right.
know, and there's current temples that are in jeopardy, like the Solip Temple, for example, which is a great temple. So we can see that, and that's devastating enough. But what other levels are there? That remains to be discovered.
All right, give us the URL for the Save Nubia Project website and your other contact information.
Okay, so our website is savenubia.org. That's our website, savenubia.org, and the campaign details are there, what our goals are, which is to raise $50,000 for the field research and to spread the word to get this area designated as a World Heritage Site. Also, our phone number for the Save Nubia Project is 510-273-2456. That's 510-273-2456. And our email is info@savenubia.org. And P.O. Box is P.O. Box 18623. That's 18623, Oakland, California, 94619. And I'm I'm the coordinator for the Save Nubia project.
Now, one thing, and then I'll let you, we'll let you go, but I wanted to point out that there were PR people who worked with the Sudanese government to dispel some of the myths about what was going on in Darfur. Has the Nubian people, have they formed like a coalition? Do they have advisors to try to help them get world attention on this issue, like their government did several years ago to try to dispel some of the inter-ethnic charges that genocide was going on and that the government was behind it, et cetera, et cetera? And I don't know whether or not it was righteous. All I know is that I met some of the delegates. I met one of the prominent brother out of D.C. who was helping them. And, you know, I did what I could to focus attention on it. But the question is, are you advising the Nubians or someone advising the Nubians how to get the message out globally?
No.
In addition to what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not really aware of all of the efforts, but I know that there are multiple fronts. So you have Nubians in Cairo that are advocating for their rights and their dignity
mm-hmm.
and their homeland. You have Nubians in the Aswan area that are organizing further south. You have Nubians, as I mentioned, the Kashubar area. You have Nubians here in the U.S. And then also you have a Dal Kashubar committee of Nubians who are against these dams. So there are multiple efforts and multiple fronts. Similar to what we do in the U.S., you have people who see the need, who see the problem, and they do what they can. But I know that the Nubians and other groups, the Manasir, have been pretty prominent and outspoken as well. In fact, it was the Manasir who were displaced with the Marowe Dam, who was in conflict with the Sudanese government a few weeks ago. And the Manasir have been as adamant as anybody because they actually tried to blow up the dam, the Marowe Dam.
Okay.
And so the Sudanese military had to protect the Chinese workers from the local people.
Right.
Yeah. And in fact, you also had other groups that literally ran archaeological groups out of their excavation areas, and they told them, "You got 24 hours to pack up and get out, or else." So the University of Chicago and others say, "Yeah, you know, maybe it ain't worth all of this."
Yeah.
So they had to take off to the local people. So you know what? The fact that the dam's being built, so they were blaming the archaeologists on the dam. As a matter of fact, anybody associated with the dam,
any outsiders,
anybody. And of course, you know, again, you can spell dam in another way. But anybody with these dam projects, they don't want. So it's really working with whoever we can work with. One of our campaign goals for the Save Nubia project, for example, is to help the local Nubian people build museums in the second and third cataract area. Because the significance of museums is obviously they help preserve knowledge of a particular area or region. So a very important thing is to build dams. That idea came in my conversations with one of the Nubian brothers who helped us over a period of a couple of days in his area. But it makes all the sense in the world to build dams, to build museums to really highlight the significance of the region. And I can see that as an economic opportunity.
Right.
Because then that's what will attract people. They can see, they can go to museums, like they do in any country, you know. So I would think, brother, really, we don't know, but I would think that the government should be in favor of that, to have museums built that could help preserve knowledge and increase knowledge of the significance of the area. Now, of course, the government may want the museums to be built and the dams as well, but I say the best scenario is no dams, but let's go ahead and build the museums and find an alternative source of energy. But so we work with whatever Nubian groups that we're able to work with, and so there's multiple fronts. I had a brother call me from Minneapolis, Nubian brother, to tell me what their efforts were. And so you have different groups because the problem is so large that everybody who is conscious has to do something to contribute to this effort.
And there's been so much struggle because there was a large contingent of expatriates in the United Kingdom because they left due to the struggles with the wars and all that stuff that was going on. So there's a large network of Sudanese who may be willing to link up and get the word out because they care about their country, even though a lot of them weren't able to go back. Now, I don't know if some of them went back once the bifurcation occurred, but you never know. So, because the ones that I was in contact with several years ago, I lost contact with them, and they were talking about basically the government in Khartoum being pro-Arab had a disdain for the Africans. So.
You know, that's pretty much what it is. And since you mentioned that, it's important for people to know is that all the people are African that we're talking about. They would be considered African if they were here, and they certainly are African. They're phenotypically African. But what we're dealing with is people who have maybe an Arab mindset, meaning that they're more concerned about embracing Islam, speaking Arabic, and identifying with Saudi Arabia, even though their lineage doesn't really go to Saudi Arabia. And there's people, so literally, brother, there are people who want to deny their actual lineage. Excuse me, sir, your mother's from Dongola. We know this. And so it's hard for them because in Sudan they don't do tattoos because of the darkness of the skin. Because of the pigmentation, they use scarification.
Mm-hmm.
So that scarification makes it clear where you're from. You can say anything you want, but your genes choose before you do. So some people want to choose some other heritage that they make up and fabricate and edit when it's convenient, but the scarification does not lie. We know exactly where you're from because they made a permanent mark on you. And that's what's so interesting is you see the mix and the diversity in Sudan, and interestingly, with all of that diversity of indigenous Africans, they're unmixed indigenous. So I was so misinformed when I first went some years ago. I really was looking for, you know, where are the Arabs? I heard it was an Arab-African conflict, and there's no Arabs. So I finally figured out that when people in Sudan, like my colleague, when he dismisses somebody as Arab, he doesn't mean it the way we do. He doesn't mean ethnically.
Okay.
He means
okay.
Their mindset.
Right, okay. All right.
Just like we saw, man, that person's a Negro. We don't mean he ain't of African descent. We mean the way the person thinks and acts. That's exactly what they mean. So until somebody recognizes that, and it took me, I don't know, I'll say maybe a week to figure out that. And once I figured that out, it all made sense because it didn't make any sense at first. So what I've done in one of our products on our website, SaveNubia.org, is after my 2007 field research, I wrote a report of my work and research at the archaeological sites, and then it's two reports, and the one is on the racial identity, and I have a collage with all of the, at that time, before the country split, but all of the top officials, every single one of the top officials, and I've done this in slide presentations and workshops. It's okay now. You see the government officials, you tell me who's African and who's not. You can't. I said exactly. So every top official, as fundamentally African as they come, I said, okay, so now let's get rid of the Arab-African conflict. That's not it. It's the way people think is a mindset. In fact, people in Darfur, all these people are African, indigenous, they speak Arabic, they practice Islam. And so why are they fighting? Well, it's because of interest. It's because of interest and land rights and people looking to move other groups out. But it wasn't some racial fight. And this is hard, brother, for people to recognize because that's not the way it was promoted. And so I know why the U.S. media was promoting that in order to make up and get people riled up and then go in and start dealing with these bad Arabs and start bombing other countries. Oh, look at the Arabs and what they're doing. Excuse me, these are not Arabs. These are Africans, some of whom are misguided, there's no doubt. But it's really complicated. That's why we focus more on the archaeological and historical evidence, and then we leave the political scientists to do what they do. But, of course, none of these things are completely isolated, so we have to at least be aware so we're not caught off guard. So when we go into an area, people don't know who you are or what you are there to do. So you got to at least talk intelligently and let them know you do know what's happening in the country, but you're more concerned about maintaining the historical evidence.
Well, as a historian, I understand your focus, but as an African and just as a righteous citizen of this planet, we have to understand that Sudan, even before, and I believe that's one of the reasons they encourage folks to split the country in half, Sudan is on the list too. You know, when they get finished going after Lebanon, Syria, Iran, they're going to target Yemen and Sudan also under the guise of the global war on terrorism, which is nothing more than modern day imperialism. So we need to be clear on that. You know, they're not going to escape.
Absolutely, and too, brother. Absolutely. Well, you know that the world community said that the Bashir government was a criminal operation, and that he should be brought to be taken into custody for criminal charges based on Darfur. And interestingly, those that were fighting with him or defending him and those fighting against the man all said that they didn't want any interference by the U.S., the U.N., or anybody else. This is their internal issues. So even his enemies were defending him because they understood that that would open the door for the U.S. and other imperialist forces to come in to the Sudan more directly and do what they want to do. So that was an interesting response by all of the Sudanese.
Give us your contact information again, your mailing address. Obviously, there's no donation too small. Give us the mailing address. Are you able to do e-commerce on the website?
Yes.
PayPal and things like that?
Yes, directly on the website.
Okay.
My name is Maynu Mpim, and I'm the coordinator of the Save Nubia Project. And our website is savenubia.org, and all our details are there. Also, we're on the social media outlets, so look for the Save Nubia Project on Facebook and YouTube, Twitter. You go to Save Nubia, we're there, Vimeo, so all of the main sites, we're there. And phone number is 510-273-2456. That's 510-273-2456. And P.O. Box 18623. That's in Oakland. And the zip code, Oakland, California, the zip code 94619. And then you can email us at info@savenubia.org. My name is Maynu Mpim, and I'm the coordinator of the Save Nubia Project. And so purchases, everything can be done online, donations, people have started to do that. That would help our cause so that we can really do the more comprehensive field research in this upcoming season. And time is of the essence. This has to be done before this next round and phase of dams are constructed and we lose more African history than we care to ever imagine. So support our campaign, the Save Nubia Project.
How can people go to YouTube? And I prefer, you mentioned Vimeo. I prefer Vimeo because it allows you to put the whole piece up there. It's not bifurcated like YouTube used to do, where you could only have 10 minutes up there. So give us the YouTube, but also give us the Vimeo and URL.
Okay. So for YouTube, it's the Save Nubia Project. You can go and you can watch our five-minute promo, which explains the project and what's at stake. And also with Vimeo, same thing. Go to Vimeo, and this is Save Nubia Project. And our video, promo videos there, we like people to share that with as many people as possible in the network. And then also we'll have a more full-length DVD available really soon. We have to edit that and put that up there, and that would be before we go and do the more comprehensive field research. But there are several videos there now, so we'd like people to take a look at it and share the information with others in their network.
I noticed I saw the five-minute piece, and then I saw some other, I think there's three other pieces up on YouTube. So just want to get clarification. Are they all promo pieces, different content promo pieces, or is one a promo piece and another is a longer version of or give you a synopsis of what you're trying to do, trying to accomplish?
Yeah, there's the one promo piece, the five-minute promo, and then the other clips are part of lectures that I've done, presentations on the Kashbar Dam and the flooding of Nubia, and also clips of the Meroway Dam and the flooding of Kush. So we have different video clips of my presentations and then the one promo that gives people a short five-minute version of what's at stake and what's happening.
Okay, just wanted clarification for myself and so other folks can see what's up there, because we need to learn and share and show folks how to use these tools to get our message out.
Yes, sir. And then too, brother, you know that it's too difficult to ask everybody to watch a hour just to find out all the details. So that's why we put it in a 5-minute
mm-hmm,
package.
Yeah,
so
folks
got it and they understand it, and then they can look at the more detailed lectures with full explanations later. But
yeah.
That's important too. But the promo is user friendly.
Now the promo is going to be on your Facebook and other social media too.
Yeah, it's there now. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So if people go to the Save Nubia Project on Facebook, they'll see the promo video there. They'll see it everywhere, and go to Facebook. They can like it, make comments, and then how Facebook and these other networks operate, it's easy to forward it to everybody as well. And that's what people have been doing over the last few days. Going to Facebook, saying yes, I like this video. I like the photos, and they're forwarding the information to their list.
Okay, brother. Well, keep up the good work. I will send you something, and I'll be supportive of you as I can be.
Well, thank you, Brother Junius. Keep up the great work, and thanks, as always, brother, for allowing us to share what's happening.
Okay. Come on. Put some more things out. I miss you on Rainbow Soul, man. We need
hey,
some of that kind of
venue. that's the next venue, brother. I appreciate you. I'm gonna do that.
Okay. All right, man.
Okay,
stay strong.
You,
okay.
Yes, sir. You too.
Professor Mainu Ampem sharing his latest initiative, the Save Nubia Project. Now, keep in mind, at one point, Sudan was the largest country in Africa. As I mentioned, Africa is under siege all over, whether it's in the north, whether it's in the Horn, whether it's in West Africa, and especially in Central Africa. So we need to understand what's going on. The siege is for raw materials, minerals, resources like gold, water, uranium, coltan. There's a major, major effort to depopulate large swaths of territory so that they can get at the resources or even displace people so they can turn that particular place into a tourist or resort, or just so that the Europeans and the aliens can relocate there. This is no joke. We're seeing our motherland under a vicious, vicious attack, probably far worse than the scramble for Africa in the 19th century and even in the 15th century, because now they have their technology and they're able to brainwash people and to get us to think that they're doing it for humanitarian purposes. In the old days it was for their religion, to save the quote-unquote heathens and bring Christianity, then it was the white man's burden. Now they're just talking about democracy or demon crazy, but it's really about the same thing. A select group of people controlling all the resources and people on the planet, and we need to be aware of that. Professor Ampem is struggling to save and retain African history so we can fill in the blanks in terms of our greatness. And if we are truly that great, and we come from great people, and we know that we do,
surely we can join with him and do this. As I mentioned during the interview, a similar intervention occurred when they intervened to save Abu Simbel from the flooding that was going to result from Aswan High Dam. And so that whole temple complex, that whole temple, even though when you go there now, it looks like you're going into a mountain, that was relocated, taken down piece by piece, and reassembled where it is now. And so if that could be done then, surely it could be done now. So if you have any questions, go to his website, www.savenubia, or if you want to send a donation, send it to the Save Nubia Project, P.O. Box 1863, Oakland, California, 94619. If you have any questions, call area code 510-273-2456. And that's about it for this presentation. This is Junius Ricardo Stanton reminding you, free your mind, the rest will follow. Until next time, stay strong.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery can reach.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates. No denomination, faith dominates, and no court is going to try.